Now we are to the middle chapter in the unit, three chapters. This one is about an overall process. We're going to look at the details of what is many steps, but it's an overall process called the complete oxidation of glucose. And you don't see that phrase in this slide, but it should have been written that way instead of cellular respiration. But anyway, let me talk about what I mean by the complete oxidation of glucose. Glucose is a fuel, first of all. Fuels are molecules from which energy can be extracted if those fuels are used. The goal, in a sense, is to extract as much energy as possible from the fuel, some of which will be lost as heat, right? There's nothing we can do about that. But if you extract as much as possible from the fuel, that means you have as much as possible to use to do what? What do we use our fuel energies directly for?
ATP.
Right, to produce ATP. So that's the goal, to produce as much or as many ATP molecules out of the energy released from a fuel molecule, glucose. Now, glucose is not the only fuel. You can do the same thing with other fuels. But we study this from the viewpoint of glucose as the fuel because glucose is the master fuel. It's used more often than any other fuel. Not just in our cells, in all cells. It is the master fuel. Now, I say the complete oxidation of glucose is what we're studying as an overall process. That oxidation word refers to how we get or extract the energy from our fuels. We oxidize our fuels to get usable energy out of those fuels. And the word complete in the phrase complete oxidation of glucose refers to how efficiently we do that. So glucose is the original fuel. You can partially spend that fuel and get some energy that makes some ATP out of that. But if you don't completely use the fuel, what you'll have left over is partially spent fuel. Well, that's not what's happening in this overall process. That's why I'm calling it the complete oxidation of glucose, meaning that you get as much energy as possible out of that fuel, leaving entirely spent energy, fuel. It's no longer fuel, in other words. Completely spent fuel is not fuel anymore. It's worthless as far as energy is concerned to the cell. And that is carbon dioxide. Now, I need you to remember what the definition of organic is. Organic doesn't simply mean carbon-containing, right? Most carbon-containing compounds are organic, but not all. And carbon dioxide is not organic, even though it contains carbon. And that's important for really what the main point of this slide is, which I'm still getting to. But fuels are not only fuels, they are organic fuels, meaning they are carbon-containing compounds that can be burned or oxidized for the release of energy. And to completely use or oxidize glucose means to completely dismantle its carbon skeleton, which is why you turn it from a 6-carbon sugar, glucose, to 6 pieces, each with 1 carbon. That's what a carbon dioxide molecule is. Not only is the carbon skeleton completely dismantled, which is part of the complete use of the fuel, but also notice that carbon dioxide doesn't have any carbon-hydrogen bonds anymore, whereas there's a lot of carbon-hydrogen bonds in the fuel originally. So that's what we do to completely oxidize our fuels. We dismantle the carbon skeleton, and we pick all of the hydrogens off of the fuel. And that is done in many steps, but in two overall subparts of the overall process. The overall process is the complete oxidation of glucose. The two major parts of that are first glycolysis and then cellular respiration. And that's why I wish that instead of having cellular respiration here, they had the whole process, which is the complete oxidation of glucose. So that's what we're studying in this chapter, the overall process. But this slide shows you that that overall process, the complete oxidation of glucose, has a reciprocal relationship with a different process that we're studying in the next chapter, which is photosynthesis. A reciprocal relationship means that one of these major processes undoes the other, or each of them undoes the other. So now we can get back to why I reminded you about the fact that carbon dioxide is not organic, it's inorganic. Keep in mind that there are two kinds of organisms in the world, ecologically speaking, producers and consumers, right? We've talked about this before. Producers can make their own food. That's one way of saying it. But a more chemically exact way of saying this is that producers and only producers can make organic compounds out of molecules that have an inorganic carbon source. No consumer can do this. We can't do this at all. All organisms, producers and consumers, require carbon, require organic compounds. Not only small ones, but building them up into the organic macromolecules that all organisms are made out of. So all organisms vitally need organic compounds. But consumers have to get the carbon for their organic compounds already in organic form. You know, when we eat, whatever organism we eat, animal, plant, fungus, anything else, it's made up of organic material. We digest that, bring in organic molecules into our cells, and we build our own organic molecules out of those. So it's a rearrangement. It's not, we don't build the same things that we eat. The point is, though, we can't build our molecules out of things that are inorganic to start. It already has to be organic, and then we just rearrange it. Consumers do that. Producers, on the other hand, can start with carbon in inorganic form, carbon dioxide, and through the process of photosynthesis, for instance, produce organic compounds. So that is the big trick that only producers can do, and that is so important that it gets its own name, which is called carbon fixation. Carbon fixation is the production of organic compounds using inorganic carbon source. Now we can get to the reciprocal relationship I was talking about. Each of these two major processes, photosynthesis on the top, complete oxidation of glucose on the bottom, has inputs and outputs. Let's look at photosynthesis. The inputs are carbon dioxide, the inorganic carbon source, and water. Two things you need to give a plant, for instance, as a representative photosynthesizer. Many steps involved in photosynthesis, and we'll get to that, but what CO2 and H2O, with the help of energy from sunlight, get transformed into are organic molecules, including glucose. So you turn inorganic carbon into organic fuel, glucose, and in the process give off oxygen. That's glucose and oxygen are the outputs, in other words. The reciprocal relationship is the fact that the outputs of photosynthesis are the inputs into the complete oxidation of glucose. So we take the glucose and the oxygen, and through the many steps of complete oxidation of glucose, which includes glycolysis and cellular respiration. We dismantle that fuel, the glucose, and strip it of its hydrogens, leaving only worthless CO2, worthless from the viewpoint of energy, completely dismantle it, CO2, and in the process turn the oxygen into water. So that's the reciprocal relationship. What we spit out then is the inputs into photosynthesis, and then photosynthesis output is our input, and so on, back and forth. Now, this figure also reminds you of something that we studied long ago, which is in any ecosystem, which is the green rectangle, energy travels through it, whereas materials get recycled within, right? Energy enters as light, gets transferred and transformed in the ecosystem, and then leaves as heat because of the second law of thermodynamics. So every step in these processes, cellular respiration, glycolysis, photosynthesis, every step involves some loss of energy in the form of heat. But a lot of the energy gets captured. And that's what we're going to look at in this chapter, how we capture that energy to make as many molecules of ATP as possible. All right, now to two. Time to revisit the theme of redox, which we started talking about in one of the labs. Remember that it's a portmanteau. It's a single word that really is two words combined. What are the two words that redox stands for? Right, reduction and oxidation. And the nice thing about combining them into one word, other than making it easier to pronounce, the better reason, though, is that it reminds you of the fact that these always go together. You never have just reduction or just oxidation. If something is becoming reduced, then something else has to be being oxidized. They go hand in hand. And what is reduction? No. That's the backwards nature of it. You're used to thinking reducing, you're losing something. Right. Reduction is the gain of electron. So it's the gaining of negativity, though. Think of it that way. And oxidation is just the opposite. It's the loss of an electron. Well, one clear-cut example of a redox reaction is ionization, which is what we're looking at here. You're starting with neutral atoms, right? A sodium metal atom and a chlorine nonmetal atom. There's a complete transfer of an electron here. The sodium gives up an electron willingly. The chlorine willingly takes it on. That produces two different ions. And so clearly that's a redox reaction, right? Something's gaining, something's losing an electron. Well, remember that whatever becomes oxidized is the thing that's losing the electron. So in this case, the sodium. Whatever is taking the electron on is becoming reduced. Chlorine, in this case, to become chloride. So that's just a reminder of what redox is. Three is also a reminder that this is just not a specific example. This is a generic scheme because X and Y are not symbols for any individual atom. It's just used as a placeholder. If you have XE minus, that means E minus is the electron. At the moment, X has the electron, Y does not, and so X loses the electron and therefore is defined as becoming oxidized. Y gains it, so it becomes reduced. YE minus is the reduced form. Okay, so that's all review of redox at this point. But in four, we can see that you don't have to form ions in order for a reaction to qualify as redox. And what we're studying in this chapter really is not ion formation. It's a bunch of redox reactions, though, involving uses of fuels. Here we have a fuel. CH4 is methane, the simplest hydrocarbon. And we've talked many times about how hydrocarbons in general make excellent fuels, including methane, which is natural gas. The reason that they make excellent fuels is for the same reason that they are nonpolar. What makes hydrocarbons nonpolar? Exactly. The two atoms involved in the single bond have roughly the same electronegativities, and therefore the shared electrons shared by those two atoms is equal sharing. Well, the only electrons shown here are the ones that are shared in each bond. The dots are a pair of electrons per bond. And you can see that in a CH bond, the electrons aren't particularly close to either nucleus, hydrogen or carbon. But think about what it means to be close to an atomic nucleus. That means to go down in energy level. Remember we talked about shells or energy levels? The closer you are to the nucleus, the lower the energy level, the lower the G value, in other words. So these are at higher G compared to what they're going to be at the end. These electrons are. They're going to end up closer to a nucleus than they are right now. Same with the electrons that are part of the oxygen molecule. Oxygen's required here because what we have as a reaction to use this fuel is called a combustion reaction. In any combustion reaction, you have a fuel combining with oxygen, reacting with oxygen. And it's going to be an exergonic reaction. That's why they're fuels. Fuels react with oxygen in combustion reactions to release energy. That's why we call them fuels. We use them in order to get some energy that's released. But if the fuel is organic, which it is here and in many other cases, including in our cells, glucose is also an organic fuel. If it's an organic fuel, it doesn't have to be methane, and you react it with water, the products are carbon dioxide and water, plus the non-material energy that comes out. All right, so this is not, it's, these aren't the products just for methane. They are for glucose or any other organic fuel. But this is also a redox reaction because the electrons get closer to atomic nuclei. Anyway, the electrons that are part of oxygen, they are being pulled greedily by each oxygen, but equally, right? So they're not particularly close to either one as well. When the reaction occurs, though, in the carbon dioxide molecule, which is completely spent fuel, notice that the electrons in the OC bond are much closer now to the oxygen than they were in the fuel originally. Right? Because of oxygen's higher electronegativity compared to carbon. So that's like a partial gain of an electron. Doesn't have to be a complete transfer of an electron in an ionization, in other words. And similarly, in water that oxygen turns into, the electrons are much closer to oxygen than they were to the hydrogen originally. So that's why this thing happens, and that's why it's an exergonic reaction, because these electrons are getting to a lower energy level. Lower G means energy has to be released because it can't be destroyed. Does that all make sense? Yeah?
You mentioned when fuel is organic and it comes in contact with water.
With oxygen.
With oxygen, what happens to the product?
The products are always going to be carbon dioxide and water plus releasing energy. Now, also important about fuels is that if a fuel is used, if it's burned, then it's the fuel that is becoming oxidized. So combustion is a redox reaction, but specifically the fuel is oxidized and the oxygen gets reduced into water. That's true for glucose as well. It's always the fuel that is oxidized. And just in general, when we say that we're using fuels, in other words, we're reacting a molecule for the purpose of extracting energy from it, that's what makes it a fuel. we do that. We use our fuels by oxidizing our fuels. That's how we get the energy out of them. Okay? That's what's all what's happening here. Now, methane is not used by us as a fuel. It is on a stove, a natural gas stove, for instance. But we do exactly the same thing using glucose as a fuel instead of methane. Bringing us to slide 5. This is a chemical reaction, obviously. It's a single chemical reaction, meaning it's happening in one step. And this is the combustion of glucose. Glucose is not the only isomer with exactly this chemical formula, but glucose has, as a chemical formula, C6H12O6. Okay, so it's glucose and oxygen. Fuel and oxygen, that's a combustion reaction. If they do react, they will make carbon dioxide and water, as I said in the last slide. So if you put a flame to glucose, which is combusting it in the presence of oxygen, then it will turn into carbon dioxide and water, and there will be a release of a lot of energy. The release of energy is the delta G. The amount of energy that gets released is equal to the delta G for the reaction. This is an exergonic reaction, so it's a negative delta G, meaning it's released. Well, if you do this all in one step, then you release all of that energy at once. And if that happened in a cell, it would be too much in such a short time. It would be too much heat. It would kill the cell. And even if it didn't kill the cell, releasing all the energy at once would not give the cell the opportunity to capture as much energy for use. Remember, heat is part of energy, but it's energy transfer that doesn't do any work. The idea behind efficiency, when you think of the goal of making ATP, is to minimize the heat and maximize the amount of usable energy for work, which is what ATP can perform. If you can use the energy to make ATP molecules instead of that energy just being released as heat, then you're doing a better job as far as burning your fuel efficiently is concerned. And that's what this whole overall process is all about, making as much ATP as possible. That's why cells don't do this in one step. Think back to when we talked about thermodynamic systems, and I told you that all organisms have to be open systems, like the open hydroelectric plant that we looked at, which was more like us than a closed system. But even better, it was the bottom part of that slide, where it was a multi-step hydroelectric plant. The overall delta G depends only on the start and end. Has nothing to do with how many steps between. Here you just have one step. So it has a delta G. That's this energy. But instead of doing this all in one step, we're like the multi-step hydroelectric plant where we start with glucose and a little bit at a time through multiple steps release a little bit of energy. All of those little bits of energy still add up to the same overall delta G as you see in one shot here. But by releasing it a little bit at a time, it's more manageable, and therefore we can use a lot of that energy to make a lot of different ATP molecules. And that's what the complete oxidation of glucose is all about, maximizing that number of ATPs that can be produced from the energy coming from one original glucose. So this is not what happens in cells. But this one reaction serves as what is called the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose, the process we are looking at. It's just we're not looking at the details in between beginning and ending here. We're just looking at beginning and ending. Notice, though, what's involved. You have to have glucose, the fuel, oxygen, and you transform those into completely spent fuel, CO2, and water, and energy is released. What we'll see, getting back to the reciprocal relationship, is that if you just reverse this reaction, this summary reaction, you have the summary reaction for photosynthesis, where you have to put in energy as sunlight, give the photosynthetic organism carbon dioxide and water, and it will make glucose and oxygen. Reciprocal. All right, now to six. You can tell from the sticks coming off of here that aren't connected to anything that this is not a complete molecule, or hopefully you can, right? This HCOH with two lines is not a complete molecule. This is really just part of glucose, or part of any fuel, really, but we're looking at it from glucose's point of view. Right? A glucose has six carbons in it. This is just one of those six carbons. But think about the overall structural formula of glucose. Each carbon is associated with a hydrogen and a hydroxyl. All right? Well, I a little bit ago told you that the complete oxidation of glucose involves completely dismantling that carbon skeleton and picking off the hydrogens. This is just one of the six carbons with hydrogen still attached. By the time the entire glucose molecule gets completely oxidized by going through the whole process, you won't have a six-carbon fuel anymore. You'll have six individual carbon dioxides, each of which doesn't have any hydrogens on it. All right, so that's where we're going here. We're starting with a six-carbon fuel with hydrogens, dismantling the carbon skeleton, and picking off all the hydrogens. All right, well, this is a reaction that's occurring, though, to part of this fuel. And just like you should be used to at this point, any given biochemical reaction is going to be helped along by an enzyme, right? Enzymes are not reactants or products, so they don't get listed on either end of the arrow, rather above or below it. So that's one reason you could tell this word refers to an enzyme, simply because it's above the arrow. But you can also tell linguistically that it's an enzyme. Why?
ASE.
Right, it ends in ASE. And not all enzyme names do, but a lot of them do. And remember also that I told you that whatever the enzyme name is, it's usually named in one of two ways. It's either named for the substrate that is specific for that enzyme that it combined to, or it's named for the process that the enzyme helps. In this case, it's the process it's named for. The picking off of hydrogens from something is called dehydrogenation, to remove hydrogens, dehydrogenate. And this enzyme is therefore named for the fact that it speeds up dehydrogenation of fuel, specifically glucose. I mean, that's what it would happen for other fuels as well, but we're looking at it from glucose's point of view. So this is 1/6 of glucose, in a sense. It's one of the carbons with hydrogen still attached. When we oxidize our fuels, which I said is how we use our fuels for the purpose of extracting energy, we pick the hydrogens off of those fuels. Okay? That involves putting those hydrogens somewhere. If you take them off the fuel, they don't cease to exist. So that's where this other reactant comes into play. NAD, which is not, those are not symbols from the periodic table. NAD is an acronym for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. And if you look at its full name, what does this tell you this thing is chemically? What's it made out of? What's the name say? It's a dinucleotide, right. So it's made out of two nucleotides hooked together. And we'll see why that makes sense when we look at the actual structure of it in a slide to come up still. But nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, or NAD, is a major player in this overall process we're studying for this whole chapter. It is an energy-carrying molecule. So is ATP, remember, right? ATP, by the way, is a nucleotide, a single nucleotide, as we talked about, right? This is a dinucleotide. It's two nucleotides big. They both carry energy. But ATP is the goal, in a sense, meaning that the whole reason you're going through this complete oxidation of glucose is to produce ATP because of its versatility in the cell. So ATP is our goal. And once ATP is produced, it can be used for a great many purposes. That's where the work comes in. Well, NAD, just like ATP, carries energy, but it's not the goal. It's just a temporary energy-carrying device that will carry energy to a later part of the process so that that energy, which was originally in the glucose and being carried by the NAD, will eventually be used to make ATP. Now, ATP is not only a dinucleotide, it's considered to be a coenzyme. Coenzymes are molecules that carry something to enzymes. Okay, so that's another way of saying, by calling this a coenzyme, that's another way of saying that this is a carrier molecule that carries energy. Since it carries things around, namely energy, in the form of electrons, I want you to think of NADs as little taxis. Electron taxis. Energy taxis. Because the electrons, which came they get stripped from the fuel itself, the electrons. But they are the energy that gets taken from the fuel. And therefore, these little energy taxis have as their passengers electrons originally from fuel, and while they're carrying the energy, those electrons, I mean, they're carrying energy from fuel. Now, based on what I just told you, well, I'll go there in a second. First, though, just to make the analogy make sense, I want you to think of them as taxis because they really act just like real taxis. A real taxi doesn't really have any destination, right? It simply is either carrying passengers or not. And when it gets to wherever the passengers are going, that's not the end of the line for the taxi, right? It goes and picks up more passengers. It's doing this all the time. But any individual taxi in the fleet, however many there are in the city, at any one moment is in one of two situations, right? It's either carrying passenger or not. It's an empty taxi or it's a full taxi. Same is true for this coenzyme NAD and another one that we're going to look at later. That's why I want you to think of them as taxis. But their passengers are energy in the form of electrons. Now, if their passengers are electrons, then what kind of reactions must they be involved in? If they take on an electron as a passenger, what's happening chemically? Redox, exactly. The complete oxidation of glucose involves a hell of a lot of redox reactions. And that's why I said we would be talking about it so much in Unit 3. Okay, now, which of the two Well, first of all, what are the two versions of NAD, therefore, since it's a redox reaction they're involved in? How could you chemically describe the two versions of the taxi, full and empty? What adjectives could you use? No, the two words that refer to whether they're carrying electrons or not. Yes, reduced and oxidized. So any given taxi is either empty or full. Which is the empty taxi? Which version? No. Oh, did I say empty?
Yeah.
Then no. The empty taxi is oxidized. Remember, oxidation is loss of an electron. They've already dropped the passenger off. Gaining the electron is reduction, right? So when the taxi takes on the passenger, the electron, it is reduced. Okay, now which of these two forms, reduced or oxidized, is the higher energy form? Reduced, yes, because the energy is the electrons. Okay, so when the taxi is carrying the passenger, it's at a much higher energy level than when it's an empty taxi. The reduced form is much higher energy level than the oxidized form. Okay, so let's look at this dehydrogenation reaction. The NAD plus is the symbol for the oxidized form. It should make sense that the oxidized form is on the left of the equation, right? Because the fuel, for the moment, still has the electrons. They're going to get passed to the taxi, NAD plus. So it should be the oxidized, empty form. The electrons, by the way, are part of hydrogen atoms that are in the fuel originally. So there's two hydrogen atoms at a time that are going to be picked off from this one carbon. That's one of six in the fuel originally. But with the remaining seconds, just think about what two hydrogen atoms are in terms of subatomic particles. If you have two whole hydrogen atoms, what subatomic particles do you have? No neutrons. You have two protons and two electrons. I said two hydrogen atoms. So in terms of subatomic particles, you have two electrons, two protons. NAD plus is the oxidized form. It's already plus. So if you take one of those two electrons and stick it onto NAD plus, that's going to make it NAD. Is that clear? Then what you have to work with still are one more electron plus two protons. That other electron plus one of the protons together make up one hydrogen atom. You see what I'm saying? And if you add those, you have NADH. And that leaves over one proton that you haven't connected. That's why the reduced form of NAD is NADH and a proton, and H+. Because that proton doesn't cease to exist. It's just not stuck onto the coenzyme. It's in solution now. It was part of the fuel. All right, I've got to stop.